OT After Dark is a podcast run by two occupational therapists and is for adults only. The views on this podcast are our own and are intended for information and educational purposes only. We believe that sex and sexual pleasure are a human right for consenting adults, regardless of ability, age, gender, or sexual orientation. We discuss topics that cover a wide variety of sex and sexual practices. To be true to our strong views regarding inclusivity, we use common and slang terms regarding sexual topics, which may be considered explicit. Listener discretion is advised.
We have exciting news to share. We recently partnered with DirectRec, a free app for OT practitioners, PT practitioners, and speech-language pathologists.
DirectRec helps clinicians to find peer-vetted products, and we recently have added our own recommendations of products on DirectRec for sexual health and wellness.
We helped DirectRec get a little extra sexy. DirectRec helps clinicians share products and other digital info, like YouTube videos and Google Docs, with their clients.
DirectRec helps you to track clients' follow-through on your product recommendations. So to start using DirectRec, click on the link on our website at otafterdark.com or in our social media bios.
Hi, I'm Kay.
And I'm JJ.
And we're both occupational therapists.
And we're here talking to you about sex.
Today, we talk to Margaret McGrath.
Yes, who is a senior lecturer at the University of Sydney. And she also leads the Sydney Sexuality Group.
And we had a pretty broad conversation from just the general lack of not just OT, but healthcare professionals addressing sexual activity, to talking about older adults and sexual activity.
Talking about online dating.
It was a fantastic conversation.
Yeah. There is a trigger warning. There is some discussion of abuse and rape in this episode, so just so you are aware. But enjoy our discussion with Margaret McGrath. So today we are joined by Margaret McGrath, who is a senior lecturer in occupational therapy at the University of Sydney. She also leads the Sydney Sexuality Group, which is an interdisciplinary group of researchers and clinicians focused on improving evidence-based practice and services related to intimacy, relationships, and sexuality for people living with chronic diseases. So welcome, Margaret. We are very excited to have you here on OT After Dark.
Thank you. And it's really great to have the opportunity to speak with you and to share a little bit about what we've been doing here at Sydney. So it was a bit of a mouthful to do the introduction, but I guess it's from my perspective, it's really great to be able to share that we are an interdisciplinary research group and we're made up of speech pathologists, nursing. We've worked with some psychologists, some medical doctors. And for me, that's an important aspect of our work, which is about supporting people with disability and chronic disease to have opportunities to express intimacy and sexuality. And because of that interdisciplinary nature, we've really sort of been able to look at different aspects of sexuality and go beyond just focusing on sexual activity to think about body image, how people relate to each other, communication aspects. And it's sort of opened up a whole space of how big sexuality is, which is kind of fun because it means that there's different topics that we can explore in depth and then hopefully influence practice so that people do have the support and the information that they need. Yeah.
So what does the research tell us about how much sexual activity and all those other things you just mentioned are being addressed?
I'd love to say that the research tells us that it is an addressed topic, but I guess, as you know, a lot of health professionals and rehabilitation professionals struggle to talk about sexuality. For example, we've recently published a systematic review in Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. And that looked at all of the research that has been conducted in terms of attitudes, practices, knowledge, comfort levels towards sexuality across a wide span from early 70s up until the present day and across geographical locations and health professionals. And what we found was that less than 15% of professionals routinely ask questions about sexuality. So that means that in 85% of encounters people with chronic disease and disability have with health professionals, nobody talks about that topic. And we also know that people with chronic disease and living with disability would like us to ask those questions. You know, it is an important aspect of life, and up to 70% of people will struggle with it or will have difficulties with sexuality or some aspect of sexuality. A really good example of this is we've worked with a stroke survivor who's quite a strong advocate for sexuality after stroke. And she said to me, you know, 3 days after my stroke, I was in the physio gym doing my rehab thinking, oh, is this it? Is this life? And she said, and this guy said to me, you look good today. And she said, that was that moment. I thought, I've still got it. Somebody still wants to fuck with me. It's like, it wasn't that he was, you know, there was nothing was going to happen. This was not anything, a big romance that was about to happen. But it was that feeling that she was still a person who could be admired by somebody else, a person who could have sexual feelings, who could feel good about herself. She's like, yeah, that day I stood up a bit taller. I thought, yeah, I can do this. I still got it. And I think that's the thing, that we assume that when people are ill or when people have a disability or they have some sort of traumatic event, we think, well, surely sexuality is like the last thing of their mind. You know, they're focused on getting better. But actually being sexual and having that part of your life, that is really important part of getting better or living with or responding to that aspect or that thing that's happened to you. So I think, you know, we health professionals, when they say, well, we don't talk about sexuality, but we've got so many other things to talk about. It's just one of those things. We've got to sort of tip that over on their head and say, well, actually, for a lot of people, this is the thing that you need to talk about, and other things will fall into place. We will learn how to rewalk. We will learn how to adapt our house, how to do things differently. But it's really important that we feel ourselves that the essence of who we are is still there, or that the essence of who we are still has potential for growth. And I think that's why sexuality is important. But unfortunately, it doesn't always translate to practice. And that's what our research group has been about. It's about challenging that practice and supporting people to change what they do.
So that's certainly been our experience talking to people, where people who've talking about their lived experience have expressed like, yeah, that was 100% on my mind from the beginning. Mm-hmm. What do you think healthcare in general, healthcare professionals need to do to get in that habit of making that just a regular part of the conversation?
I think we have to have some conversations with ourselves about what is it that we value in our interactions with people. Because on the one hand, it's, you know, it's very simple to say, well, we include it in our initial assessment. We include it in our evaluation forms. We include it as a KPI that we measure against. But what we found is that when we looked at the barriers and facilitators to supporting people, including sexuality in practice, simply having it on an assessment form was not enough, because people knew that, well, it's there on the assessment form, but actually nobody really is going to do anything if I skip that line, right? There's not going to be a consequence. And that comes back to sort of a broader aspect of, well, why don't we value this? Why don't we see this as a critical aspect to get right? And I think that reflects sort of broader societal attitudes around sexuality and disability, sexuality and age, that kind of sense that only people who are young, fit, healthy, able-bodied, preferably male, preferably heterosexual, those are the people who can be talking about sexuality. Those who have beautiful bodies, beautiful, you know, everything. That's what sexuality is presented to us in every day as being. And so then if we are influenced by that, and of course we're influenced by those attitudes, we kind of, that's what influences how we practice. And we see it on our assessment form. We go, well, let's just focus on getting home, because that's the thing that I'm going to be judged on, not whether I said to you, well, do you know how to put your lipstick on? Have you been able to do your hair? Have you had the clothes that you want to wear brought into this rehabilitation center? Or, you know, when you go home and we're talking about you needing a hospital bed, do you want it to be a double bed or a single bed? Is there somebody that's going to sleep in that bed with you? And is that important to you? Those are all things. And I think the other aspect, of course, is that people get hung up and think, oh, I don't have that much sexual experience. I don't know what to do. What if they ask me something really weird that's outside of my comfort zone or my belief system? Or, oh, I don't know what to do. And of course, the reality is that most people don't need to ask a therapist about sexual information, about the act of sex. Mm-hmm. Of course, they might have some problems with it, and they might need some support about getting access to reliable medical information. But generally people are pretty good at figuring out what works for them in terms of sex, right? So it's the other aspects. It's that sense of you still have sexuality. Your sexuality is still legitimate. Your sexuality is valid, and it's a reasonable concern. So I think as healthcare, going back to your question, what should healthcare professionals do? We really need to start thinking from the very beginning, what are the values that drive us in working with people? And if we work with people with disabilities because we believe them to be equal, have the same rights, same capabilities as ourselves, they need some different supports, then we should value them as people, right? And if people are people, well, people, part of sexuality is part of being a person. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a values thing. And the values, if we get that bit right, then the other things will fall into place because the values will drive our behavior. Yeah. Well, that's my thoughts anyway.
Yeah. I'm very beautifully said.
Yes.
Because it's kind of reminiscent. I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine who works in oncology. She's an oncologist. And kind of this discussion of, okay, a lot of times medical professionals or physicians will be like, well, I'm giving you these life-saving drugs that are going to save your life. But then not necessarily have that conversation of, well, what does life mean?
Quality.
You know, what is that quality of life? Like, you know, the fact that you are alive, doesn't, you know, that doesn't, things don't stop there. And what does life look like? So kind of looking at it from that broader perspective.
I think so. And I think also not getting hung up on the idea that it's all about sex. And if I'm not comfortable about talking about sex, then maybe I don't talk about the whole aspect of it at all, right? My colleague Sandra Lever has done some work around women after stroke. And she has this beautiful phrase that they talk about is skin hunger, right? So being hungry to be touched in a way that is not about clinical care, it's not about rehab. It's about being touched because somebody wants to touch you as an intimate connection with you. And I think that's the thing, is that we think, even some people, I remember being at a conference and chatting to an older man, and I think he came to talk to me because he felt a bit sorry for me because nobody wanted to talk about sex. And he sort of came up and he said, you know, I'm a bit old for this sex stuff. So, you know, I'm not really going to be much used to you, but we can have a chat. And so we were chatting about his journey through stroke recovery and what had happened. And, you know, sort of 3 or 4 minutes into the conversation, you could sort of see him thinking. And he went, do you know, actually, maybe I could have done with talking to you about this when I was coming home from hospital. Because he said, the thing that struck me was I'd been in hospital for a long period of time. My wife was waiting for me at home. I got a taxi home. I got out of the taxi. I was really looking forward to putting my arms around my wife and giving her a kiss. Yeah. Right? And he got out of the taxi. He walked up. He practiced getting in and out of the taxi. He practiced walking. He was doing good. And then he got up to the front door and he realized that he had a hemiparesis and he didn't know how to lean in and give her a hug and a kiss, right? So this was not about him wanting to have sex with his wife. This was about him wanting to have a connection. And nobody in his rehabilitation journey had said to him, it's going to be a bit tricky to do a big hug when, you know, one arm isn't moving as well as it used to, but let's practice that movement, right? They practiced getting in and out of the taxi. Practice doing the walking up the laneway. Yeah. But the big moment for him was that she's going to open the door. I'm going to give her a big hug and a kiss. I haven't been able to do that because it's not something they would have done in a hospital location or in a rehab center. It was a private moment. And all this build up. And he's like, yeah, I'm home. And then he was like, and then I realized, oh, I've had a stroke, right?
Yeah.
This is not good. So it is that, exactly that, you know, we've got people to the point they're at home, but if they can't connect in the way that they want to, and it is driven by what people want themselves, not by what we're assuming they want, then it's a bit of a problem. We're not fulfilling everything that we could do for them.
That idea of wanting that hug, I mean, that was a common, when I worked in a skilled nursing facility, a lot of older adults, I mean, that was probably one of the most common motivating things to get up and moving was, I want to hug my significant other. I want to give them a kiss, but I want to give them a kiss in that upright position that, like, we're used to. But definitely not a focus of therapy.
And I know. And it's, you know, it's a similar story my colleague tells me, Sandra. She's a clinical nurse consultant and runs a sexuality clinic. But again, had a young man in her clinic and he's talking about wanting to have sex. He's used to using the missionary position, but he's not sure that he has enough upper body strength to maintain that, right? And he's really worried about this. This is a focus for this young man. And she said, well, have you spoken to your physio about that? And he's like, could I talk to my physio about that? And she's like, well, duh, you know, you can work on that upper body strength. That would be a really good thing to be working on in physio. And of course, the physio was quite happy to work on upper body strength. But can you imagine the motivation level to work on that upper body strength in that position and to think about that in relation to what he actually wants to achieve versus somebody sitting there with, you know, some gym weights going, oh, this is fun, you know? And all in his head, he's thinking, well, I'm able to have sex with my girlfriend in the way I want to be able to have sex with my girlfriend. So I think the motivation is much higher. And it goes back to fundamental occupational therapy practice and fundamental healthcare practice is if we're there for the goals of the client, we should be there for the goals of the client, right? And mostly the client will have those goals, whether they tell us or not. They'll be thinking those goals. So wouldn't it be easier for all of us to be working on the same page?
Yeah, right.
I
think that's probably my biggest hope, probably our biggest hope with the podcast is just to get that in people's heads. Like, yeah, we're supposed to be there to be looking, like JJ said, like quality of life issues. And that it shouldn't just be like, let's get a little stronger for this vague... this vague idea of being more independent with various things.
Yeah, what's the motivation? Yeah. What's the meaning behind why you want to?
Exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. And I suppose also it's about knowing that, you know, if we feel shy about talking about this, if we feel uncomfortable, the person across the table from you or in the bed is also going to feel uncomfortable. Because I have heard some clinicians say, well, I did ask about sexuality and they said, oh, it's not for me. And you sort of think, well, maybe it was a cold ask and maybe that wasn't a good way to ask that question. But also, you know, it's okay to ask and be told no. Because saying no is a choice, right? So if you offer me a product and I say, oh, no, thank you, that's not for me, that's very different to you saying, oh, that's not for you, so I won't even offer it to you.
And I think it's important too, because even I think, of toileting with this. So many times I've asked during an evaluation, like, how are you with toileting? And, oh, fine, fine, fine. But if I ask more details, like, can you wipe yourself after a bowel movement? Then suddenly it's like, oh, well, not exactly.
Not exactly.
Like if you build that relationship and you start to get a feel for what questions to ask, then you get the bigger picture of what's going on.
Yeah. I think there's something as well about some kind of clinical requirement that should be there, right? Because, you know, you see somebody do a chair transfer and you think, oh, there's no way they're able to transfer onto the toilet. Having watched them try to transfer onto a regular chair, you don't just walk out of the room and go, well, they tell me toileting's fine.
Yeah.
You probe a little bit more and you say, oh, well, I noticed that it was a bit tricky to get on and off that chair. You know, your toilet maybe is a bit lower than the chair. There's nothing to hold on to. How's the toilet? Because it seems like it would be likely that that's going to be a bit tricky. And then they go, oh, yeah, actually.
Yeah, and that needs to translate to sexual activity. Because, I do think that people, if you uncomfortably ask it once, no one's going to. Yeah. No one's going
to. And because we all leak, right? So if I ask, so how's your sexuality when my arms are closed and I'm like looking at the wall going, please don't answer.
Yeah.
Just say fine. Then of course you're getting a very strong message from me that what I want to hear is, oh, there's no problems. I don't need to talk about that. And I mean, you know, some healthcare professionals, and in the paper that we talked about, we looked at some of the qualitative interviews with health professionals, and there's been a huge number of studies. There were 114 papers included in this review. So it's not like we don't know about this, but one of the things that was really evident was that healthcare professionals, not only are they uncomfortable, but they're also very good at making sure that the person who is brave enough to ask the question is redirected.
Yeah.
And so there's very clear evidence that healthcare professionals will smile nervously and change the subject, or just say, well, that's not appropriate right now, or this is not the service that can resolve those questions. So we have to take a little bit of ownership about the level of discomfort that's there in the room and say, well, hang on a sec, we have the training. We've had the opportunity to practice our conversation skills. We know how to address difficult questions. I mean, you ask a healthcare professional, have you ever asked somebody about toileting and bowel movements and going to the toilet and managing cleaning their butt? And they're like, yeah, that's no problem, right? You ask them, have you ever asked them whether they can have sex in a way that's meaningful to them? They're like, oh, no, that's way too difficult, way too intimate. We ask about money, we ask about relationships, but we don't ask about other aspects of life because we say it's too uncomfortable. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's a bit of a challenge.
We were just talking to a group of students last week, and I said, like, the number of times I've walked in a room, introduced myself for an initial evaluation, and within 5 minutes, I have them, like, in the bathroom naked and don't think twice about that level of intimacy. Of like, hi, I just met you. I need to see you undress.
Yeah.
But then people shy away from the topic of sex and intimacy.
It is on people's minds. It is something. It's a natural. I mean, when you talk to people who've had trauma, who live with chronic disease, it is definitely a concern. And one of the consequences of us not addressing it is that we give a very clear message to people. You have a disability, you have a chronic disease, you ought not to be concerned about sexuality. And so certainly some of our stroke survivors, and we've worked with a lot of stroke survivors to develop some services and interventions to address sexuality after stroke. But some of the comments, they really make me realize the damage that we cause by ignoring sexuality. So for example, I've had a stroke survivor say to me, oh, well, I can't talk about that because it's so painful, I've put it in a box. And so I really would love to be in a relationship, to have somebody to be intimate with, to be loved by somebody, but that's not going to happen for me because I've had a stroke. I've, you know, been a young person who's had a stroke, so I've put it into a box. Now, the thing is that if you as a stroke rehab professional said to her, have you got any concerns about sexuality? Her first response would be to say, no. But that's not it. That's not an accurate reflection of where she's at. But she said, you know, it's such a sad story and nobody will ever love me and I don't feel lovable. So I've put it in a box and it's there and it's sore and it hurts and I don't want to talk about it. And then the other sort of story that you often see coming through the literature, and, you know, we looked at the experiences of stroke survivors. And so there's a paper in Clinical Rehab about this, and it's sort of that people become very vulnerable because we've denied their sexuality. And so they open up to people who perhaps are not the nicest people to them. So there's certainly some clear evidence of women accepting sexual behavior that we would otherwise call assault and possibly even rape, because of feeling that because of their disability, they ought to be grateful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nobody else will love me. So I put up with abuse. I put up with things that I wouldn't ordinarily put up with, but I've got a disability. Nobody will love me. So that's the message that we support by ignoring the other aspects, because we say, well, let's put it in a box because it's not relevant to you. And so there's somebody out there who's vulnerable and of course who wants to have intimate connections, but potentially ends up in quite a harmful situation because we haven't had an open dialogue to say, yes, you've got a disability. Yes, sex might be different. Yes, you might look a bit different. You might speak a bit different, but no, you don't have to accept anything that's not consensual, that's not fulfilling what you need and what you want, because there are other options for you. Because we shut it down. We say, oh, no, we're not going to talk about sexuality. Yeah. So there is a challenge there.
Which to me ties, and I know you've written about this, I know we've presented on this, the idea of a sexual rights approach when we're in occupational therapy about addressing that, and that we really need to go into this like with this idea that people have a right to participate in sexual activity and a right to sexual expression. Could you speak a little bit on sexual rights?
Yeah, and I think people get a little bit anxious when they hear that language because mm-hmm. they think, oh, what does that mean? And who's going to pay for it? And when do those rights stop? And, you know, it immediately brings you into a different sort of dialogue. But fundamentally, everybody has the right to express themselves in a way that makes sense for them, that's, you know, obviously in the bounds of their own context that's legal. But I think if we start from a rights perspective, then we don't have to be the nice therapist who will talk about sexuality or the weird therapist who everybody sends their clients to talk about sexuality, because it's a right that everybody should have access to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that moves us also away from a charity model. And it recognizes that sexuality is diverse, that people express their sexualities in different ways, but we all have the right to do that. Here in Australia, that has been challenged a lot. Recently, we've had some discussions about the National Disability Insurance Scheme, mm-hmm. which provides funding for people. and looking at whether or not that funding can be used to support people to access sex workers. And so there's been a lot of discussion about, is that good use of public funds? Is that appropriate? But then if you come back to fundamentally, we have the right to be have safe sexual activities, to have access to sexual information, and to plot our own sexual destiny, well, then you've got to say, well, yes, it is a right. Mm-hmm. And everybody has the same right. Because if we say that somebody with a disability is the same as me, then they have the same rights as me. Yeah. And it's as simple and yet as complicated as that, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That sums it up. Simple yet complicated.
And I think, yeah. And I think that's the challenge, is that immediately when we sort of see sexuality as sort of a desire rather than a need, right? So you sort of say, well, people can live with that sexuality. Nobody's going to die because they haven't had sex, or nobody's going to die because of lack of intimate contact. So we sort of say, well, it's not really a fundamental need. It's a desire. And desires are things that you have to, I suppose, in some contexts, you have to have enough resources to access. You don't get them as a basic right. But I think if we go back to what are the consequences of ignoring sexuality, mm-hmm. people end up feeling, you know, this, the research shows us with higher levels of depression yeah. and anxiety, poorer quality of life. And yes, we're not going to see massive cost savings because we address sexuality, but we are going to see people's lives improve mm-hmm. and the quality of the life that they live improve.
Which should be our aim. It should be our goal.
It should be, right? It should be our goal. And I think most of us, and I think when we talk to most clinicians, to most therapists, to most rehab people, they go, yeah, that's important. I can see that. They don't have a big argument that says, that's, yep. you know, it's out of bounds. But what happens is in the day-to-day practice, it gets deprioritized. Mm-hmm. It's not rewarded. We don't get, you know, stars for saying we're really great at doing sexuality in this center. And there are other things that get, you know, higher priority because they save money or they're seen as somehow influencing outcomes more than yeah. sexuality does. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's challenging.
Those darn outcomes.
I mean, and I was just, as I was saying that, I was thinking the other challenge, of course, we have is our research around outcomes and sexuality is not terribly well developed. Mm-hmm. So we do have outcome measures that look at sexual function, but mostly heterosexual function and mostly male dominated, mm-hmm. although with some exceptions. But we don't necessarily have a good global measure of sexuality that you could pop in easily into a standard intake outtake form to say, look, we improved this over time. So the outcome and the measurement of sexual outcomes is difficult. And it's also about what do you include and what's mm-hmm. in sexuality mm-hmm. and what's out of sexuality. And if you look at that broad WHO definition of sexuality, well, there's a lot of things in there that could be measured. Yeah. And a lot of them are soft things. Mm-hmm. They're things that do change gradually over time. So the kind of the temptation is to say, well, okay, we can measure sexual function. That's pretty okay. That's, you know, we can measure arousal, we can measure ejaculation, we can measure all of those things. And again, it's male dominated, mm-hmm. but that's a whole other situation. But then if we do that, we risk really narrowing our focus. And for occupational therapists, our focus is bigger than just sexual mm-hmm. function. Mm-hmm. You yeah. know, we're looking at how do people date? How do they form those relationships? How do they prepare for it? What are the activities that they engage in? This year I've had a really interesting student work with me, Isaac Ip. And he's been doing some research around how people date in different cultures. So he's been looking at dating in Hong Kong and dating in Australia. And it's been, we're looking at it from an occupational perspective. So what do people actually do? And it's been really interesting looking at that and seeing most people spend extended period of time negotiating their date, you know, so texting and long kind of online conversations. Online dating is really up, right? Mm-hmm. This is 18 to 35 year olds, so younger than me. But also the sort of things that they do. So a lot of the time it's hanging out. It's just hanging out with each other. And, you know, they sort of quietly slip into dating mode, but they have to have the opportunity to hang out. And one of the discussions Isaac and I have been having, and with Anne Hanley is the other person who's been working on this, is sort of to look at, well, what are the opportunities that people with disabilities have just to hang out? Mm-hmm. And that's a bit of a challenge, particularly if you've got a funded support network. So you know, in order to go to the movies, you need a support worker, and that's going to cost you X amount of dollars per hour that that support worker is there. So if you want to go on a date, you probably organize it very specifically. Mm-hmm. So will you go on a date to the movies between this time and this time, or my support worker will be there? But actually what we're seeing is a lot of young people, they kind of hang out for 3 hours and then they go, oh, maybe that was a date.
Yeah.
Maybe the next one will be a date. So it's things like that that we can kind of influence if we know more about it. Because certainly from this work, we're sort of thinking about, well, how do people get opportunities for casual hangouts when a lot of their socialization is supported by funded support workers who are on an hourly rate and mm-hmm. they've got a limited budget? And then the other thing that we noticed was there's a lot of indirect communication and a lot of subtlety in about how do you interpret and how do you present yourself in this social media rich environment, right? And that's a skill in itself, mm-hmm. right? And I think anybody, yeah. regardless of whether they have a disability or not, will go, well, it's a bit of a skill to put yourself out there on the internet dating platforms. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're sort of thinking, well, how much do occupational therapists work with people and work with speech pathologists, speech and language therapists, and work with psychologists to think about how prepared are you for this online dating world? How do you interpret subtle flirtation? And what does digital flirtation actually look like? Mm-hmm. And what kind of skills do you need for that? And also then from psychologically, how do you deal with building up resilience for rejection, for ghosting, for all of these? You know? And so they hurt everybody, right? It's not easy for anybody. But then if you add in a layer of complexity that, you know, disability and all kinds of attitudes that you may or may not have internalized and just all that kind of stuff can make it really complicated. And so then when we have occupational therapists and somebody says to their occupational therapist, well, my goal is, I want to have a girlfriend, or I want to have a boyfriend, or I want to be in a relationship. And the occupational therapist thinks, okay, let's think about that. Well, what do we do? Well, we actually don't know what to do, right? Mm-hmm. Because we don't know much about the occupations of dating. We might have an idea that maybe they need to know how to ask someone on a date, but where do they find the person to ask on the date? And when we looked at young people in Hong Kong and Australia, mostly they were finding them through their dates through work or through school. And then if you have a disability and maybe you're out of the employment sector, maybe you've gone to, you know, special schools, or maybe you've not been in school that much. How do you form those connections? And that takes time. So, and then you've got this goal-driven therapist who says, like, oh, we must get you on a date. And you think, oh, no, yeah. this is not going to work out well, right? And it can very easily go in the too hard basket. That's too hard. Let's go for a much yep. more concrete goal that's achievable. And maybe that goal is that you learn how to set up an online profile, but that's not really what you wanted to do.
And I think we do that as a profession with everything, not just sexual activity.
Yeah,
I think that's our fallback is to take that easier. I'm really curious, were there any significant differences found between Australia and Hong Kong and dating?
It was an interesting, there definitely are. And I think we'll chat a lot about it. But what was interesting was, and it's got to do with context a lot, that people in Australia were more likely to meet at a particular place. People in Hong Kong were more likely to use public transport. And so that whole public transport thing formed part of the date. So they would go on the train together. Wow. They'd get to the dating location. Similarly, they kind of all did this hangout thing. And, you know, this is sort of stereotypical. I think there was more alcohol involved in the Australian dates than there was in the Japanese dates. And I mean, that's me being a little bit facetious. The full analysis isn't complete, but there definitely are some differences. And I think also that whole idea of being connected through other people, you were more likely in Hong Kong to meet through other people than you were in Australia. It was more likely that you could meet people outside of your immediate social circle. And it was interesting because we had quite a strong multicultural perspective, and I think there was some differences coming through on that. So we're still in the final stages of analyzing it. Isaac is finishing soon, but it'll be out there hopefully in the next while.
I look forward.
But the thought that struck me though was that, you know, our idea about dating might well be grounded, and you know, I don't want to reveal my age, but it might be grounded in my own experiences of dating. And so we don't have a wide literature to draw on in mm-hmm. occupational therapy. And that's a problem because we know occupational therapy is predominantly middle class, predominantly female. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those ideas and assumptions don't reflect our client groups.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's it's a lot to learn, I think.
And then I just keep thinking, then you throw a pandemic into all of that,
and then how does that change everything?
Yeah, I think so. And I think one of the things that we heard a lot about in Australia, and I don't know if it's been the same in the US, is the potential for that pandemic to put people who were already in fragile mm-hmm. situations and difficult relationships, to put them at higher risk. Yep. And certainly we saw in the survey that people were doing a lot more online stuff than perhaps they would have done when they were able to do face-to-face. And it was compounded in Hong Kong, because there's been a lot of political unrest in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. so lots of things happening there as well. But I think what it does make us aware is that we all have vulnerabilities, and it's sort of, you know, we need to talk about it, to bring it out in the open, at least allows people not to feel alone with their vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I could talk about this forever. you want to shift? I think we should shift to, I'm looking at an article you co-authored on older adults, and we haven't had a chance. We haven't really talked at all much of the on the podcast about the older adult population.
Yeah, and I think it's the one that we need to really pay attention to, because mm-hmm. of course most of us, and I think probably myself included, we come with the assumption that, well, older people, haven't they been there, done that, and they're over it? But of course that might be focusing on one aspect of sexuality, or it might just be based on a very ageist assumption. Mm-hmm. And our work with older people, and this was done in Ireland with another student of mine, Anne-Marie Highland, and it was really looking at the original study was with Anne-Marie Highland, and one of the things that came out of that was that Irish occupational therapists really had difficulty asking about sexuality with older people. So then with Ethna Lynch, the following year, we thought, well, let's talk about this older people issue, and why is it that older people in particular are problematic. And drawing back to the other stuff, is the interesting thing is that it's not just Irish occupational therapists.
I was just going to ask. I don't think it's an Irish thing.
No, I don't think it is an Irish thing. But what was interesting is that when we look at where rehabilitation professionals are comfortable talking about sexuality, and comfort is a relative term here, but they do sort of say, oh, you know, somewhere between 20 and 35 we're kind of comfortable. Before that, you're too young, and after that, you're too old, which is a bit depressing for those of us who are not in that demographic. but it's sort of that assumption that unless you're in this sort of active point of life where you might be considering having children, then and even that, the time frame is pretty narrow.
But and like you said, sort of assume, it really struck me earlier when you said we have an idea of how people should look, that there's mm-hmm. like a certain aesthetic we associate with somebody who's sexually active, which is completely false.
Yeah, right.
But it's
right.
definitely there.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is the research really does challenge us in that it is very much false, because if we look at the people where sexually transmitted infections and diseases are growing, it's among an older age population. Mm-hmm. Right? They're the people who are the fastest transmitters of these issues right now. But they're also the people who are the most neglected in terms of education and awareness, and mm-hmm. thinking about, well, hang on a second, has anyone talked to you about sexuality? And it's all of it is based on an ageist assumption that, you know, sexuality doesn't matter to you as you get older. But in fact, we know that that's not true. And we only have to look at our own parents or our own grandparents and say, well, does your mom still like to look good? Do they like to choose good clothes? Do they like to feel good? Well, yeah, is the answer. Of course they do. Yeah. Does your dad like to dress smartly? Does he like to shave? Does he like to present himself well? Does he like to go out to dinner? Yeah, of course they do. Do they still like to hold hands? Mm-hmm. Do they like to kiss? Do they have sex? Who knows? Maybe they do. It's not a question I've ever asked them, you know. But I can assume that, you know, if it's important to me and I'm an older person, because every day I'm older than I was yesterday, then yes, it's likely to be important to somebody who just happens to be 10 years older than me, or 20 or 30 years older than me. And I guess it's also about respecting older people as people. And it comes back to that issue, you know, if we see people as people, as people are the same as me and you, they have the same rights as me and you, then they have the same right to sexuality as I do. And if you're going to say to me, well, sorry, you're past the cutoff point, I'm going to be a bit annoyed.
No sex for you.
Sorry. So no sex for you because you're over 35. You're not in a stable relationship. You don't happen to be heterosexual. Mm-hmm. You're not male. Oh, you've got a disability or you're living with a chronic disease. No sex for you or no sexuality for you. Right? It's not just lack of sexual activity, but it's you can't be beautiful, you can't be flirty, you can't play with your body image, you can't present yourself in a certain way. So if we say that's no for those people, then it must also mean no for me. And that's where the drive to improve things comes from. But in terms of older people, the other thing that people often focus on is sort of risk management and behavior management and sort of saying, oh, well, they're too old, they're vulnerable, and you know, somebody's going to take advantage of them. They don't have capacity to give consent. It's not right. They wouldn't do that if they weren't not of sound mind, or they're becoming older. They're not responsible anymore. And I sort of think, well, that's pretty patronizing, isn't it? And you know, but it's also, when we see older people in residential aged care facilities, we think, well, do they have an opportunity to engage in intimate relationships? And very often policies are quite against that. Mm-hmm. We had a conversation with a group of residential aged care facilities here and in Sydney. And one of the things they instigated at the request of their residents was that there was a sign that residents could put on their room that said, do not disturb, right? And it was a way of saying, look, actually, I'm having an intimate moment with this person and I don't want to be disturbed. Like, none of us would want to be disturbed, right? Mm-hmm. And this, remember, this is their home. So at home, I have the right to say, I'm not answering the door right now. I'm busy doing something else. But of course, in residential aged care facilities, very often it's dinner time or it's medication time or it's therapy time and the door is open regardless. Anyway, they got this system up and they put the signs up. And they said it worked really well. And there were two groups of people that didn't follow the rules. The first were the adult children of the residents. Yeah. So they saw the sign on the door that said, do not disturb. And they went, yeah, but mom doesn't mean that's for me. You know, and you're like, well, actually, mom really does mean that's for me.
Find out the hard way.
Yeah. And the other one was people visiting professionals, right? So professionals who weren't attached to the residential center, but who were coming in to provide a service. And so they were like, well, I'm sorry, but I'm here. So it's either now or never, and I'm going into that room. And you think, really? This is client-driven care, right? Mm-hmm. So theoretically, we're supposed to be driven by the goals of the client and what the client wants. But very often in the day-to-day, we go, well, that's all very well for you. It applies to everybody else, but I'm here and I'm the therapist and we're supposed to do therapy. And it doesn't matter if the door is closed or not, because this is the therapy time, right? So that's a challenge. And I'm not saying, look, there's constraints and people are working to billable hours and they're working to goals and there's commitments that you make. But there also has to be flexibility to recognize that people have other things. And it comes back to, well, what's actually really important to the person at that moment in time?
It has to be considered.
Not even
partnered, but I mean, masturbation, I think of that often in inpatient, those residential facilities, the lack of privacy for masturbation. And you don't know when someone's just going to, like, walk in. decide it's their time to...
Yeah, to see you.
To do whatever it is. Yeah. And it is that leads then to people saying, people starting to think that they don't have the right to be sexual because they're living in a residential facility, or they don't have the right to be intimate, or they don't have the right to privacy. But we all have those rights. Those rights are there for everybody. And I guess it's up to us as therapists to think, okay, there's a sign on the door. Yes, that might be frustrating if I have an appointment and I've got things that I need to do. But maybe at this moment in time, what's more important to this person is that they have this, either they're masturbating or they're having intimate activity with somebody else. So perhaps they just don't want to see anybody right there at that moment in time. But that's what's important to them. It's not what you've come to do. And it should be based off of what's important for the person. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not advocating that, you know, people make appointments and they don't turn up, because of course that's the, you know, people say, well, you know, here I am, this busy therapist. But it's about going back to goal setting and to really listening to your client, isn't it? And saying, well, what are the things that are important to you?
And I think too,
and if it's
you brought up a really good point too, that like these are these people's homes, like where you're almost a guest then in their home. This is their home environment, where this is your work facility. So kind of like having that in the back of your mind too, that like if someone was in your home and you were with your bedroom door shut, like you're not going to want someone bursting through your door.
That happened where I worked, and we knew the resident in question and his wife, like they had asked for daily, they were very clear about it. We have sex every day. We need this time. Close the door. Don't come in. And everyone was fine with it. But then there was one person, I think it was a social worker, just kind of ignored it and walked in and got an eyeful and was horrified. And we were all like, well, why did you walk in their room? The door was closed. You didn't even bother. Like, you may have knocked, but you clearly didn't bother to like wait. You just walked in. She didn't get a lot of support from the rest of us.
it is interesting, isn't it? Because you know, on the one hand, you know, that system works and I can sort of see that it works, but then when we listen to people's accounts of their sexuality, particularly after they've acquired disease or disability, they talk about lack of spontaneity. And that's a bit of a turnoff as well. If you have to say to the nurse in charge or the manager, when the door is closed, that means I'm having sex. You're thinking, well, everybody knows.
Everybody knows now, right?
And you sort of think, oh, they're going to be looking at me going, how was it?
Because like, that was the thing. Like it was part of daily report because everyone needed to be notified because unfortunately the open door was the norm. Closed door wasn't the norm. So it was discussed with like every department. I'm sure all the way down to kitchen and housekeeping. The entire facility knew that if the door was closed,
that was what it meant.
That's what
so
was
you
happening.
Kind of sort of think, oh, wouldn't it be tough if you had to go to a case conference and the people say, so did you have sex this morning? Oh no, you're planning for this afternoon. Okay, let us know. 2 to 3, is that the time? Like, it's really not really what most people plan in terms of having sex or what they would necessarily want to have in terms of sex. But it goes back to, you know, when we're talking about dating and hanging out and having that opportunity just to be the way you want to be in the moment that you're in. And that's the sort of thing that we need to think about in terms of how we provide services for people with disability and how we provide supports for people with disability, is to give some flexibility for spontaneity, because that spontaneity is an important part of flirtation. It's an important part of sexual arousal. And we need to support people to be able to have it. Because, you know, I think most of us, if we were told, well, the sex timetable, here you go, this is what you've got. You feel like, oh, I feel a bit under pressure. It's not going to be very enjoyable for most people. It's challenging. But I think the first step is always going to be to acknowledge that, you know, people have the same rights as you and I. It just so happens they might use a wheelchair, they might use a prosthesis, or they might look different, or they might be bigger, smaller. I don't know, whatever it is that our aesthetic for sex is. But they're still people, right? And if we recognize them as humans, then we recognize their sexuality, because to be human is to be sexual. And we know that that's true, and it doesn't stop just because somebody gets a disease label or a disability label. It's as easy and as complex, right?
I feel like you just perfectly closed this out.
Right? On that profound statement right there.
It's tricky. It's tricky, but there's a lot to do with it. And I think it's a very interesting topic to learn more about. So hopefully we'll keep doing that. Hopefully see some impact on our work. Thank you for the opportunity to chat about it. It's good to talk about it and hopefully get more occupational therapists in the conversation.
That's the big goal, is getting more OTs talking about it and more comfortable talking about it, and giving resources and everything too. So thank you again.
This you're is very welcome.
A fabulous conversation.
Thank you very much.
Another fabulous episode.
Another one in the books.
Woo woo.
Tell everybody where they can find Margaret.
So you can find her on Twitter at OT_Ireland. We also, if you have questions, her email address is margaret.mcgrath@sydney.edu.au. And as always, we will post this information on our website.
Along with the articles. We did reference quite a few articles today. And we will have all those available on the website.
So as always,
sex is an ADL.
Cheers.